Welcome to the Placebo Magic Podcast, the podcast about imaginative self-care for skeptics. I'm your host, Durmok, the wizard and peasant lord of the vast 10-acre realm of Hobdur, also known as Garrison Benson. Greetings, placebo mages. Today, differentiating the world we subjectively experience from objective reality. But first, thank you to our newest Patreon backers, Beulah and Rachel. And thank you to our Patreon supporters at the producer level or above, Alconet, Emily, A Sociology of Tarot, Agnominimus, Annie, Beulah, Brianne, Carrie, Dev, Fonka, Gyun, Tony, and Valerie. All right, so today I want to share this concept that I've been thinking about a lot lately that I think may be useful to anybody who is trying to sort of, you know, practice placebo magic or just more generally trying to sort of reconcile the fact that we're not fundamentally rational beings and that we have to find ways to negotiate with our irrationality and sort of just live our day-to-day lives in awareness of that fact. And this is a concept that I call the experienced world or the experienced reality. What we do as placebo mages is, generally speaking, we, you know, do different kinds of sort of tricks to manipulate our own psychology for, you know, to help us serve our, you know, long-term goals. Looking at it from this kind of, you know, scientific sense, the methods that we're using are, you know, fundamentally operating on our own psychology. That's a great way to think about it scientifically. But it doesn't necessarily match up with our actual experience of our lives. Even the most rational among us, in our inner lives, in our moment-by-moment lives of experience, what we experience as the world outside of ourselves is, in fact, a representation of the world that our brain has kind of assembled through all this sensory data and through our kind of prior knowledge of the world. And through these kind of systems that our brain has for interpreting different kinds of data. And so it's kind of like an impression of the actual world rather than us experiencing the actual world directly. We take in the sensory data through our eyes, which don't see all of the same colors that other animals see sometimes. We take in sensory data through our ears, which have this particular, you know, range of hearing, and that differs from person to person. We take in, you know, data through our other senses, and so we have these raw data that's already kind of filtered, and then we have the kind of operations that happen on top of that, like our sight is passed through these systems of like object recognition and motion detection and whatever other kind of, you know, hardware that our brain uses to kind of process so that it's not just gibberish. It actually means something. We can kind of parse out distances based on, you know, using both of our eyes together and using our knowledge about how the world works and all that stuff. So you've got the raw data, you have this additional layer of like interpreting that data sort of mechanically. And then you have another layer on top of that of just like what that means to you, what emotional reactions that causes. And so we have this judgment layer of like, okay, that's good, that's bad, that's interesting, that's boring, that's an opportunity that's not worth pursuing, that, you know, et cetera. We have all these value judgments that are just part of our moment by moment experience. And, you know, a lot of times, we, even the most rational among us, will kind of use this sort of mental shortcut of confusing the two and assuming that if we're experiencing something, then it must be sort of objectively true. So, you know, one example of this is emotional reasoning, where you kind of use an emotion that you're feeling as evidence. So you, maybe you're feeling lonely and you kind of think that because you feel lonely, that is evidence that you don't have a good support, social support network, which may not be true. Or if you're feeling angry, you may take that as evidence that somebody wronged you, when in fact, you know, that may not be true. And the whole concept of being wronged is not a concept that you find in the sort of measurable outside world. It's a subjective concept of that exists in, you know, in human minds. Just being a human being, it's helpful to just be aware of the fact that the thing that you internally experience as reality, this world outside of yourself, is still all happening in your brain. It does sort of point to reality and kind of it's a suggestion of reality, but it's not the real thing, and your senses are finite and limited. Your ability to parse those senses is finite and limited. You know, I always think about that example of the that famous study on like attention, where they it's like show people a video of a basketball game and have them count how many passes are made during this, I don't know, minute or two clip. And then during the clip, a guy in a gorilla costume walks across the video. And then, you know, they kind of ask people afterward, did you notice anything unusual in the video? And very few people notice this guy in the gorilla costume because they're so focused on counting the passes. And, you know, that's just to suggest here that, like, most people, I think if you told them something like that had happened right in front of their eyes, they would just not believe you and say, like, that is impossible, that I would have noticed that for sure. It's one of those kind of like studies that just is very humbling as just being a human being to know how flawed your attention is. And we tend to interpret our attention and our memory as being representative of reality and being like, well, if I don't remember something that seems like it should be notable, then it must not have happened. Or if I didn't notice something that seemed like it should have been notable, then it couldn't have happened, when that's just not true. You know, that's just not how it works. We know that like eyewitness accounts in courtrooms are unreliable as evidence. We know that our capacity to notice things is very limited and very flawed. And that's okay. So just as a first starting point, just understanding that, okay, the experienced world, the thing that I perceive as being the world outside of me, is still part of me biologically. It is a function that is happening in my brain. It is like a representation in my brain. It's like Plato's allegory of the cave. If we're people who want to believe ourselves to be rational, the rational thing to do is to understand those limitations, not to pretend that we're experiencing reality objectively. Now, to take this and put it more in the context of practicing magic, we can perform, you know, like spells and rituals and prayers and whatever else, where we are trying to achieve a result that is not operating on what we think of as self, but is operating within our brain. And I think that when you're doing a kind of a spell like that, obviously, if you're trying to justify it to your sort of scientifically minded, you know, skeptical self, then of course you're going to put it in terms of like, well, I'm just trying to manipulate my psychology. But in terms of your actual subjective experience, a lot of those kinds of magical goals, they're going to be targeting something outside of the self that is part of this like represented world, this experienced world. And so, for instance, let's say that you are casting a spell to ask the, you know, the universe to bring you a job. You know, looking at it more rationally, what you're probably trying to do is to manipulate your expectations, and so that you expect that a job is going to come your way, and so that you're motivated to look out for a job, your attention is primed to notice opportunities, and you may be more motivated to like be ready for those opportunities when they come by, you know, preparing your resume or whatever else you might need to do as preparation, so that you can pounce on an opportunity when it pops up. When you're asking like the universe to bring you a job, where you're spell is really addressed, like the thing that you're asking is actually this represented world, this experienced world. It's all of these systems in our brain that are operating in this kind of unconscious way that don't feel like self, they feel like world. So it's your, you know, your capacity to notice things, your capacity to judge things as being a valuable opportunity versus being something not worth your time. There's things that happen in a split second, and they don't, you don't necessarily always notice that they're happening, but they color your view of reality so that it changes where you, you know, direct your focus. As rational, skeptical sort of folks who are interested in using this kind of brain hacking toolkit of magic, certainly when I started practicing magic, I was always a little squeamish about spells that were sort of operating outside of the self, you know, because I thought, well, I want to do this in kind of a skeptical way. I'm going to only do spells that are kind of performed on the self. Like I'm going to do spells to get more, you know, courage or confidence, or to make me think more clearly, or help me to balance my mood or whatever, that things were like explicitly sort of in the realm of self. But as I've gone forward, and especially as I've learned more about those kinds of processes of attention and perception and awareness and all of those things that the brain uses to kind of build this representation of the world, the more I've become aware of that, and especially its limitations and how it's doing all these mental shortcuts to, you know, be able to do this complicated task so rapidly so that we experience it in real time, that represented world is fundamentally a different thing from the real world. And so it does make sense, I think, to perform magic, perform, you know, prayers, whatever, that are asking the, quote, universe to change in some way. And, you know, for those of us who have experienced, like, depression or other kind of mental health filters, like I'm using filters in kind of the Instagram sense, it's like you can have this one variable that pivots in your brain. And so, like, you know, your brain going into this depressive mode, and that colors your entire perception of the world. It's like, oh, suddenly I feel lonely. And so a lot of times you interpret loneliness rather than feeling it as loneliness. You might experience that in the experienced world and think, oh, nobody cares about me. There's nobody who's there for me. It is this neurological process of depression, but you experience that as a change in reality. And likewise, depression has this learned helplessness element. And so you might look around at the world and say, well, nothing I do matters. There's nothing I can do that will change anything significantly. And of course, that is a perception that is a function of your experienced world. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a clinical mental health experience to have that kind of effect. If you just skip breakfast, that can change your world. You know, if you go 5 days without experiencing sunlight, that can change your world and transform it into like a hellscape. I know for me that 2 consecutive nights with bad sleep completely transforms the landscape around me as I subjectively experience it. You know, the world becomes less vibrant. The world becomes less interesting. Everybody becomes more annoying and irritating. Everything seems to take too long or you know, it's like nothing is quite right. And of course, if you don't stop and think about it and realize, oh, this is just my experience. This is not evidence of the way that the world is. When I was younger, I went through a number of phases in my 20s where I was like, well, if there is a God, then he probably is mean, because that just was my experience of the world. But when I started getting into meditation, I realized like, oh, that's just the way my brain was processing those things. And there's other ways that my brain could be processing those, you know, everything around me. To tie this into one of the mini topics from last month, I talked about this idea of the self as a kingdom or the self as a mythic landscape. And one of the examples I used of that is how in fiction, there's sometimes this trope of when the rightful king regains the throne, the landscape is transformed for the better. And like when an evil person takes the throne, the landscape is transformed for the worse. So a great example of this is the Lion King, where when Scar is king, the landscape becomes this like desolate, dead landscape. And when Simba returns, it sort of magically transforms back. And so, you know, in the real world, obviously things are not that simple. You know, I think a lot of times in terms of political discourse, people try to simplify it to that degree and say, oh, like, this person became president 3 weeks ago and now gas prices are down. They must be doing a great job. And it's like, well, that's just not that simple. But in this kind of inner mythic landscape of the mind, you know, your whole world, as in the sense of this experienced world, can transform overnight or transform as the result of like what voices inside of yourself are you putting in a seat of power that can completely transform the landscape of your experience. And so if you have this kind of like harsh, critical, judgmental voice that you are elevating to this sort of throne of power and treating that as the ultimate authority in your mind, then your entire landscape of the world that you inhabit subjectively, the world that is your day-to-day experience of, you know, these representations your brain is assembling of layers of perception and meaning and everything else, is going to suck. Whereas if you kind of treat that voice as just one voice at the table and you have all these other voices that you're listening to and you don't take that harsh, judgmental inner voice so seriously, then the whole landscape becomes kinder and gentler. And it's like teleporting to a different world, or it's like that kind of magical transformation in The Lion King, where I used to be in a hellscape and now I'm in a paradise, or at least just like a pretty cool, vibrant world. a lot of times we, even as like, you know, really rational people, we just don't realize that we think that we are reacting to reality and we have no other choice but to react to what is there in front of us because we think that's just the way things are, when we don't realize just how much our judgments and our perceptions and our misperceptions and our prejudices and everything like that are coloring our experience. And we don't experience that process as self. And so we can easily make that mistake in thinking that we're just reacting to the world, when in fact we are responsible for our perceptions and our judgments and our experiences to an extent. Those are part of what we are doing, whether we consciously experience it that way or not. We are making those judgments. We are making those processes. And it's okay to be flawed in that regard. Nobody has this objectively correct real-time experience of the world. We all have these sort of mental processes and heuristics that simplify and reduce the world into a representation that can sort of run in real time in our mind. But you got to be aware of that and know that that's not the same thing as reality. So my ultimate motive for this episode really is to give you all and myself permission, in the sense that, you know, as skeptics, it can be hard to sort of rationalize the idea of performing a spell that has a target effect that is outside of our self. But like the concept of, you know, placebo magic in general, the most rational thing you can do sometimes is to recognize that we're not fundamentally rational people, and to operate within those constraints, you know, that reality has imposed upon us, rather than to pretend that they're not the case. Our day-to-day experience is that a lot of these things feel like they are not self. So I think it's just natural, as you are practicing magic or self-care, to act as if those things are outside of yourself, even though you know sort of rationally that they're processes of your brain. It's okay to give yourself permission to experience life that way, and it's not going to make you this kind of abandoning reason for madness kind of a, you know, mistake. It's really just accepting the parameters of experience that we all have and working within those parameters to, you know, help yourself be a better person and meet your goals. And now it's time for Secret Spells and Riddlesome Rituals. Today, using priming to manipulate your expectations and in turn manipulate your experienced world. Okay, so one of the very common sort of uses for magic that we've talked about on this show in the past is to, you know, manipulate your expectations, which is kind of the core idea of the placebo effect. You create the expectation that you're going to get better, and then your body kind of does some sort of unconscious processes as a result of that expectation that are helpful. And, you know, besides the specific case of like healing, there are a lot of other examples where we've discussed using magic to manipulate expectations. Like if you're trying to find a relationship, trying to create the expectation that, you know, a special person is going to come your way will make you more likely to notice the opportunities there that are around you and more likely to kind of take action on those. And so I want to talk about a specific method that you can use to create expectations. So typically we've kind of talked more about using sort of, I don't know, magical authority, or just willing yourself in some sense or through some process to believe that it's going to work. And that's one way that can really work. Another method that you can use in tandem with that is what's called priming. And this is a concept from psychology where you sort of show someone a stimulus, and then later on you show them another stimulus, and the way that they interpret the second stimulus is sort of shaped by whatever that first stimulus was. So, you know, maybe an example of this might be something like you flash the word doctor in front of someone's face very briefly, and then you show them a very blurry version of the word nurse, and then they are more likely to be able to parse that blurry text as nurse if they've been primed with the word doctor, whereas if they weren't primed with the word doctor, they may interpret it as some other word, or they might just not be able to read it. Our brains have to work really hard to make sense of the world in this rapid, real-time kind of pace. And so we're not just going off of our sensory data, we're also going off of our expectations as kind of an heuristic So depending on context, we might interpret stimulus or your sensory data a little bit differently based on what we expect to see in that context. So by introducing other elements to the context, you can manipulate your expectations. One way that I have used this sometimes in magical practice is when I want to summon a, you know, sort of spiritual presence. In other words, I want to experience this kind of subjective perception of a presence being there with me, helping me. You know, one way to do that, the sort of most straightforward way, is just to sort of ask that presence to come. So, you know, I do this sometimes with Thich Nhat Hanh or Mr. Rogers, like I've talked about in that Saints and Sages episode. The most straightforward way is to just ask them to come, but then you can also kind of create the conditions for their appearance by setting up the other sort of stimulus or stimuli that would typically coincide with that person's appearance. So, for instance, with Mr. Rogers, I could play the audio of the theme song of that series. Or one thing I have done in the past is kind of make a little like effigy of Mr. Rogers by draping a sweater over the back of a chair, draping some pants over like the seat of the chair, I don't really have sneakers, but putting some shoes on the floor, and then kind of visualizing as if that's Mr. Rogers. And then, yeah, with the help of the music and maybe video clips of him, it makes the idea of him being sort of spiritually present more believable to the brain, because the context is there. The context in which he tends to appear is there. The scenery is more coherent with the goal that I'm trying to have. And for Thich Nhat Hanh, because I have experienced him primarily through his books, I would set up some of his books on my table or around me, and maybe also play some audio clips, because I've heard some interviews with him, and so I know what his voice sounds like. And so those are the primary ways that I have interfaced with Thich Nhat Hanh, and so those are the symbols that sort of coincide in the past with his presence. So by putting those symbols out, that primes my brain to expect that sort of presence to manifest. You can also use this in order to try to channel certain virtues. If you can think of a person who has expressed those virtues who you admire, whether that's a real person or a fictional person doesn't matter too much, but you can take on elements of that person's like wardrobe or mannerisms. Even if those elements that you're incorporating into yourself are superficial and don't have anything to do with that virtue, it can help to, I think, create that priming effect where you, on some level, your brain might believe, okay, the person who dresses this way acts like this. The person who has this kind of speech mannerism that's quirky and interesting acts like this. So I'm going to take those on as a way of like setting the stage for that virtue appearing in myself. Or if you have a time in your past when you have been able to, you know, have this strength, then you can incorporate symbols that correspond to that time in your life. So, for instance, for me, one thing that I always have a difficult time with is trying to do work over the long term in like at a sustainable pace. I tend to be kind of an ebb and flow sort of person where I work really hard, burn out, relax a lot, and do it, you know, rinse and repeat. And I feel much better when I can pace myself slow and steady, you know, like the tortoise and the hare kind of thing, and work at something consistently over the course of many months in a row. And so I have one particular time in my life when I felt like I was very successful at that, which is when I was building this pond. So if I want to sort of cultivate or like draw out or summon that sort of virtue, I can, first of all, just sort of look at the pond and visualize myself back there in the time when I was building it, and kind of imagine like the sensory experiences I had with the breeze on my skin and the sunlight and everything like that. But I can also, you know, listen to the podcast that I was binging at the time when I built that pond. You know, I listened to a few specific podcasts. And so if I go back and put those on and then also put myself in mind of the memories of that construction and put myself in that space and whatnot, then all of that starts to serve as a priming effect where I'm more easily able to tap into that part of myself and that potential strength that I can have. And so you can use this sort of priming effect in all kinds of different ways. Just the general idea is you want to find sort of adjacent elements on your associative memory. So like anything that your mind just sort of correlates or corresponds with the thing that you want to summon, you can set those elements up around you and sort of create the expectation for things that go with that. I was thinking about this with respect to community theater, where, you know, when we're first doing our, you know, kind of staging of a scene, it makes it more difficult to remember lines because you've just added another element that's one more mental thing to juggle when you actually add the movement and staging and all that. But then later on, when you have practiced it that way with the staging and the dialogue and everything together, it becomes much more difficult to remember your lines when you are just doing a read through and not staging it, because all of the elements of staging have become priming for your memory to be able to call forth your next line. So you're not just going off of the previous line and your cue line. You're going off of where you're standing, where you're looking, how your body is being presented, and, you know, what's happening in the musical backing track, and all that stuff makes it much easier to remember your lines. And so you take yourself out of that context and suddenly you're like, oh, I don't remember any of my lines. But the trick is that you need to be properly cued. And I mean cue not just in the sort of theatrical sense, but also cued in the sort of almost like a habit cue sort of sense. And so you can experiment with this in ritual by kind of using these correspondences and correlations and, you know, associative memory connections to summon the thing that you want by setting up adjacent things. You can also use it in a more casual way just by thinking about how you want to design your living space or your office desk or whatever, putting in elements that will prime you in this more passive way to notice and appreciate and experience the things that you want. You can find the Placebo Magic Podcast and my poetry on the web at garrisonbenson.com. Leave a voicemail for the show by calling 989-318-4118. Music is by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com and licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. You can support the show by giving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing an episode with a friend, or becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/placebomagic. Patreon supporters also gain access to our Patreon-exclusive bonus show. Remember, magic is a metaphor, and metaphor is magical.